came from that is that significant components of the bug fix was a hardware related patch. So these were BIOS updates that needed to be installed on particular pieces of hardware. So this then relied upon the manufacturer of the system to release a new BIOS update for that computer. Well, it turns out that the BIOS updates, some of them were not as, some of them had basically had unintended consequences. And it certainly did not affect every single device of a particular model type. It was never something like that because clearly manufacturers went through their dev testing processes. So this was really an issue of random, seemingly random computers would just shut down. And it wasn't a nice, clean shutdown process either. It was just the computer is down. Now, I haven't heard of this happening to any actual real servers, but I have heard of this happening to some laptops, and I've seen some laptops crash as a result of that particular thing. Also, unfortunate as part of this Spectre and Meltdown bug fix implementation was that for the machines that were actually fully patched, they have definitely adversely been impacted in terms of system performance. Some of them, the difference in system performance has been very noticeable, and in others, it's been slightly noticeable. And really, the interesting thing is the differentiation between those really has to do with the speed of the hard drive of those systems. Yeah, so. The machines that have exclusively solid-state hard drives really experienced the least adverse impact with regards to performance degradation after this bug fix was applied. So, because of all this brouhaha about performance impact and it being adverse, and then this whole question of, well, maybe it's just going to crash the systems, there's actually been a lot of people that have decided to not apply and install this bug fix. Now, I can't say that I really agree with that strategy, but I'm also not going to criticize them for that judgment because, really, I think there's a lot of systems that are out there in the wild nowadays that could never be fully patched. How many people are running a 5-year-old, 8-year-old PC? Well, those systems, well, you're never going to be able to patch those things because you got no hope to chance in heck that the manufacturer is going to release a firmware update for that computer in the form of a BIOS update. And then, well, here's another interesting kicker. What about all these mobile devices, right? What about all of the various little tablets, such as iPads or Android tablets, right? What about those devices? How are they getting patched? These are all questions that need to be, considered if you are the owner of any of those sorts of devices. So, anyways, that is the latest on Spectre and Meltdown. And if you are experiencing significant adverse performance degradation, the thing I would suggest you to do is not to chuck out your computer, but if it's a server, go buy a license of Diskkeeper Server for it. If it is a PC, go check out Diskkeeper Home Edition. I mean, you can get 3 licenses of Diskkeeper Home Edition for, I believe it's less than $50. So, wow. I mean, why wouldn't you? I do recommend that if you get any of that type of software, you certainly should maintain what's called the software maintenance on that software so that when the new version comes out, you can install it. And this actually has a pretty significant ramification. I'll give you an example of it. So, most of the PCs that I've seen that had, say, the older one version, one major version of Diskkeeper installed on them, one major older version of Diskkeeper installed on them, they are now not behaving as quickly as you'd like. So when you go through this process of upgrading that version of Diskkeeper to the latest version, because you maintained the software maintenance, this now gives you the ability to install the latest version of the software. If you do that, interestingly enough, you actually find that performance coming back. That performance degradation that you had noticed in terms of the difference between, yeah, well, the PC was like this before, and now I upgraded my Diskkeeper software and I gave the computer a couple days to work on optimization. Well, hey, you know, it's fast again. So it really does pay to keep your software updated. You know, in contrast, it's just astonishing how much the adverse financial impact is to businesses who sit on old ancient versions of software. I know of a company right now that is unable to upgrade their workstations to new hardware because you can't get any new hardware that doesn't have Windows 10 64-bit on it. And really, why would you want to? If you can't get a modern operating system on it, then why do you even want the computer? Because it can't be secured, right? Well, they've got this huge roadblock with being able to get any new PCs, and it is simply because they're still using a 9-year-old accounting application that was never intended to run on a 64-bit computer, let alone Windows 10. So, you know, what is the adverse financial impact of that? I'd say it's pretty sizable. All right, so let's move on to another very interesting thing here, which has to do with crypto miners. There's this whole debacle that's it's just ubiquitous on the internet at this point, is crypto miners. And what's happening is these hackers are injecting their crypto miner code into advertisements in JavaScript. So if you don't have a perimeter security appliance that is able to AV scan the JavaScript, and if you don't have something like advanced threat protection, boy, you're probably hacked right now. And I say this because there's just in January of this year, it was rated that 17% of all organizations already had the RIG exploit kit installed on their computers. Now, the RIG exploit kit was being delivered as an exploit for Flash, Java, and Silverlight. So, you know, tons of browsers use Flash, tons of browsers use Java. And so this also brings up another interesting point, which is the version of Flash and Java in your environment fully patched? If it's not, well, boy, you better get there and, you know, get that taken care of. And I think there's a common misconception with regards to people thinking that software is going to pop up and tell them when it needs to be updated. That is not always the case. It will happen sometimes, but it is not a mechanism that I would ever count on. And especially if you're actually running with any semblance of a level of security, meaning that you're not browsing the internet as an administrator, are you even going to be shown these little software messages as a non-administrator? And oftentimes the answer is no. I mean, some applications will, but not everything does. So we really come down to the whole point of, if you're going to have a patch management strategy, it really needs to be a patch management strategy that is 100% consistently reliable. And the only things that I ever see, and I've been doing this for 25 years, so I can tell you that what I tell you is, you know, this is pretty much fact, okay? There's really only two ways to have a full, consistent, reliable patch management strategy. So strategy one is you actually have a patch management system with automation, quality control, and integrity enforcement, meaning you have the ability to look at an inventory report and know at any point in time what is the patch status of the computers that you're responsible for managing. The other alternative is really what I would consider to be scheduled end-user driven management. Now, end-user driven management is not viable inside of an office environment. It's not viable inside of a business environment because end users should never have administrative access to computers in a business or office environment. The only time when end user driven patch management is even remotely viable is in a case where it is a single computer owned in a residential situation by a person, and they have the dedication to follow a checklist to patch their system every month, or really you need to be checking at least twice a month, and that you're going to set a task for it. So you can have a task reminder and you're going to diligently do it. Now here's the other problem with that approach, which is, do you even know how to do that? Every single piece of software that's on your computer has a different method for checking its patch status. It also has a different method for patching it. So Flash is different from Java, which is different than Chrome, different than Firefox, different than Silverlight, different than Windows updates, and, you know, just take it from there. Go yada, yada, yada onwards. So it's, you know, fundamentally, you need to get it done. So this whole element I started off with was crypto miners. And what's happening is these crypto miner exploits are getting installed via a web browser onto computers that are not sitting behind a hardened network security appliance. And, you know, so they're getting infected. And I've got two other interesting topics tied right on this, or I should say two other stories tied right into this same exact topic. One is that I recently looked at a pharmacy environment that has never had a network security appliance in place. They have no segmentation in their network. There's no micro segmentation, let alone any segmentation. The endpoint security is not sophisticated enough to pass HIPAA or PCI compliance. Now, what I don't know if you all know is that there are certain standards of feature set capabilities that have to exist in an environment that is required to be regulatorily compliant with HIPAA or PCI. And in those two circumstances, you know, there's this technical feature set. So for example, it says your endpoint protection must do A, B, C, D, and F. And one of those is logging, of course. And at the network layer, it says it has to be able to do A, B, C, D, E, and F, and of course, logging. So I bring up logging because this is something that is really super easy for you to ascertain. Does the endpoint agent have logging with reporting back to a centralized management console, generating weekly reports that are reviewed then by security personnel? If the answer to that question is no, if any portion of the answer to that question is no, you do not have a PCI or HIPAA compliant environment. Now you can ditto that whole thing with regards to network layer security. If you do not have a network security appliance with logging configured completely, not like just a little bit of baby, you know, baby smack of logging, but real true HIPAA compliant logging, well, you don't have HIPAA compliance either. And by the way, in most cases, HIPAA compliance and PCI compliance are identical when we're talking about the technological infrastructure aspects. I mean, obviously HIPAA is different from PCI with regards to the human behavior aspects, which says your humans will handle this type of information in this way. But that is always outside of the purview of the things that I care about, because I'm not sitting in an HR department advising people how to write HR policies and training manuals on, you know, how to train people to behave in correct manners. I'm only concerned really in the infrastructure technology side. What can we do on that side to make the jobs of human beings easier and more compliant and just protect them from making mistakes? Because sometimes people make mistakes. So I started all this by talking about this pharmacy who is clearly not HIPAA or PCI compliant, and apparently has no interest to be so. And unfortunately, I could tell you about gas stations that are like that as well, that I have, you know, intimate knowledge of, that they have no security at all, but yet they're taking your credit card and debit card transactions constantly. So they're not even remotely PCI compliant. Not even the least bit. So I tell you all of this because from a consumer perspective, you need to be thoughtful as to who you do business with and how you do business with them. You know, think very carefully and ask yourself the question, do you think that that company has adequate security? And unfortunately, 9 times out of 10, when you're dealing with small shops, they don't have adequate security. Now, I'm not going to put everybody in that bucket, and I'm certainly not going to say that every large company has got their game plan together either, because I could certainly tell you about 250 personnel healthcare organizations that are the absolute worst from a security perspective that I've ever seen in 25 years. I mean, ridiculous. And they have no desire to fix anything. So just terrible management. And so, of course, that puts all of their customer and patient information under extreme risk. And the patients and customers of those facilities have no ability to know where the identity theft originated from. Where did the breach originate from? It's almost impossible to track these things. And if anybody even knows about it, it's going to be the IT support personnel that, if there's any at all, that support that organization. And I can tell you they're not going to rat on themselves, right? I was just having a conversation earlier this week with an insurance agent. I was telling this insurance agent that, you know, look, you talk about all this like cybercrime, you know, liability and things like that. And the reality is that IT service providers, it's almost impossible to prove that they engaged in negligence, willful or otherwise. And it's almost impossible to prove that they engaged in fraud. But yet, you guys have heard me talk about these things on this show rather frequently. And I believe that the professionals in a particular industry need to stand up and inform consumers so that they're not being taken advantage of. So, you know, this issue exists that if you do business with these organizations that do not really have appropriate levels of protections in place, it's your identity that's going to get stolen. It's your healthcare record that's going to get stolen. And you may say, well, what's the purpose of these governmental regulations if people don't abide by them? Well, I'm going to tell you right now, there's no enforcement mechanism. There is no enforcement mechanism. It is a self-reporter system. So, for example, let's say you are a retailer and you take payment cards. So, you're supposed to have to comply with PCI. Well, what they do is they send you a survey and you fill it out. And if you just say yes to everything, whammo, you're PCI compliant. Right? You're fully authorized to take, you know, merchant card transactions. So, at what point is there an enforcement mechanism? Well, interestingly enough, GDPR in the UK and Europe now is coming to light. But until there are, and this is based upon large company surveys, they're basically saying that until there are huge payout lawsuits associated with GDPR, they are really not going to spend that much time and energy on becoming GDPR compliant. Because, you know, it's a pain. So, I mean, these sorts of things I just shake my head at and say, boy, okay, so we're not going to do the right thing because it's just too painful. I mean, it's just stupid. But as a consumer of these services, you need to be aware that these sorts of hanky-panky issues go on, and so that you can make a more informed decision. And as I said, I want to caution you, don't make an assessment that says, okay, this is a small business versus this is a big business, and the big business is always going to have better security, because I think we all know darn well that's not the case. How come TJ Maxx and Target and Equifax and Home Depot have been hacked so many times we've lost track? I mean, the federal government itself gets hacked. You know, so it really comes down to, can you determine based upon an evaluation of various practices that they have, can you determine whether they have good IT security practices? And, you know, actually a really good delineator is whether or not their network closet looks like a pigsty. And I've seen some of those in some, you know, fairly sizable gas station chains. You go and look at what they've got and it's just chaos. And when you see something that's chaos like that, it's probably, you know, the owner's son or nephew or something like that slapping the stuff together. Certainly not somebody who's a professional who has been, you know, 2 decades of experience. So then that just gives you a good idea about how they're handling everything else. So keep your eyes peeled, right? Keep your eyes peeled. Be observant about what you see so that you can reduce the risk profile for yourself. Now, again, on this topic of why you really need to have a network security appliance, on February 28th, an article came out on the on Wired where they were talking about some researchers who found that website analytics are literally stealing usernames and passwords. And, you know, maybe 10 years ago, you might remember there was all this brouhaha over spyware cookies, and there was all this cookie management software, and you were stripping HTTP headers and really doing a lot of things to try to protect the privacy of your stuff as you're browsing the internet. And of course, we still have all of those concerns and we still have all of those techniques. But what I've experienced over the last several years is that, you know, I feel very strongly that website analytics need to be blocked. And I use a very sophisticated, extensive, layered defense approach to dealing with that. But some people don't see the value in that. They say, oh, well, my website doesn't work now. You know, it doesn't work the same way. So I just, you know, I just want it to work. So convenience is more important than getting hacked. You know, it's, well, so sure enough, here's this article by Wired where they're talking about if you allow analytics, whoops, well, probably usernames and passwords are getting stolen then. So it just goes back to this whole realm of, you have to not only have good security practices, but you also have to have good human practices. So why would you want to be doing online banking and your accounting and, you know, sophisticated, sensitive, confidential actions on the same computer that you're looking at Facebook, right? And Twitter and, you know, ordering garbage off the internet, right? You need to be aware that if you're putting usernames and passwords to sensitive systems such as your bank account into a computer, then if you then go and do insecure actions with that computer later, that data could be compromised and harvested. And that is what these website analytics are actually doing. All right, so let's talk very briefly about some pretty exciting news that happened earlier this week, which was that University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee said in a public release statement that they were going to migrate their phone services to Skype for Business. Now, this is really, really fascinating to me. And I say this because, you know, Microsoft is the largest phone provider in the entire world right now. And that may shock a lot of you, but it's the reality. And if you look at just the attempt to try to get a new phone system nowadays that has, let's say, less than 100 extensions, which is not that big of a phone system, it's going to be $50,000. So now imagine the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee campus. How many phone extensions do they have? Probably 1,000 or something like that is probably some crazy, crazy thing. And of course, those phone extensions are wired to a physical location. They're not, it's not really all that selectable for you wherever you're at. Yes, there is technology such as Avaya IP Office, absolutely, where you could make phone calls from home. You know, your computer could be the phone system. but that still is ultimately tying back into either hosted Avaya IP office or the on-premise Avaya IP office. And I have never seen anybody actually publish a side-by-side comparison, but I've done my own little analysis. And on the surface, what it appears to be is that Avaya IP office in a completely comparable, so a fully comparable methodology to Skype for Business, is more expensive. And I think actually natively there's things that Avaya IP Office just can't do that Skype for Business can do, just simply because it's so deeply integrated with Office 365. Although Avaya will tell you that they have full integration. And actually it's very integrated. Just the question is, to what degree? And I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on that. So this is really significant news that UW-Milwaukee is going to Skype for Business, because this is now, you know, the bell chime for everyone out there to say, so if UW-Milwaukee, with as many phone extensions that they have, can make it work and they can see it being cost effective, especially over the long run, then, you know, maybe we ought to be checking into that. And I can certainly tell you, I've been using Skype for Business phone calling for several years now and have migrated several clients to it. They've really enjoyed it. You do have to be aware, though, of the infrastructure dependency technical implications of any system like that. And that is outside of the scope of what I wanted to talk about today, but that is something that I'd be happy to talk to you about if you wanted to call and talk about such a system. So for the few brief moments left of the show, I wanted to talk very quickly about security and voice over IP. This is an enormous topic. So many things nowadays are voice over IP, and it comes down to a question of how SIP compliant and how compliant in general with IP standards and networking standards is that particular provider or that service. And I've recently become aware of, in a very firsthand manner, about how my telephone systems and NEC phone systems use a proprietary methodology for SIP natively. And so what that does is it makes it very difficult to achieve SIP compatibility with other true SIP devices. So the reason that this is really important you understand these things is when you're thinking about buying some technology, you first have to look at your whole long-term plan and say, well, boy, you know, I probably should just get something that's going to be cross-connectively compatible with everything else that's on the market. And because I just don't know necessarily what I'm going to want to do in the future, but I don't want to spend a bunch of money on this and then be limited in the future. So really, your only way to make sure that the thing adheres to standards and is going to be forward compatible is probably if you get somebody who's highly technical involved and help you with that procurement process. Well, that's it for today's show. I hope you enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com. This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, Chuck Wolbers, a special education teacher with Kenosha Unified Successful Transitions for Exceptional Students Program, and Steve Brown, assistant professor of educational leadership at UW Oshkosh. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
the District 4, 5, and 6 seats on the Racine Unified School Board for the 2019